Okay, Doctor, I'm all scrubbed up. Shall we begin?
Yes, Doctor, let's. Hello, patient. Oh, he can't hear me. Okay, I'm making the incision now, Doctor.
Well done, Doctor. Lovely cutting action.
Bone saw.
Bone saw.
Thank you, Doctor. And I'm in, removing the fat from around the area.
Oh, you hit an artery there, Doctor.
Oh, so I have, Doctor. Sorry, patient. Oh, he can't hear me. Oh, good Lord, I've accidentally pulled out his liver.
Oh. So you have, Doctor. Whoops!
Oh, no, his intestines caught him. I watched. Darn, his clinging pillories.
Vacuuming the blood out and warming up the laser gun now, Doctor.
What the hell is going on in here?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Oh, goodness, my fresh stock. It's ruined.
Sorry.
Oh, it's you two Foley artists coming in messing with my fruit and veg again. Go on. Go on, make your audio sound effects somewhere else, you loonies. Go on. Out you go. This is a fruit and veg shop, not an audio studio. Out.
Sorry.
Sorry. Celery?
Celery.
Oh, my leg. My leg, I think, is broken.
Ah, celery. Backbone of Foley sound effects and all-around good fodder for your body.
Can't beat a bit of celery. I don't leave home without it. And welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast on the Audio Drama Network. I'm Ellie Maitland.
And I'm Sarah Golding. Hello. And you lucky folks, today we have the best ever guest we could possibly get to tell us all about Foley in indie audio. Ellie Maitland from Wildclaw Theatre in Chicago. Welcome, Ellie. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's so very cool to hear you and speak to you and fathom your amazingness. So you are part of Wildclaw Theatre. Is that your first kind of group you've been embroiled in doing Foley?
That they were my introduction to finally getting some hands-on work in this discipline. I had seen it done before, but this was my first chance getting to do it. And I've gotten to work with a bunch of other theater companies since then, since I started with Wildclaw. But they're really my family. They're my hometown heroes. And they're the people that do the programming I'm most excited about on a regular basis.
Yes, because it's exciting. You don't just stay put. You go on tour as well, don't you? Is that right?
Yeah, when we can. We've gotten a couple of opportunities. Our flagship show is called Death Scribe, which is a live audio drama festival, and it's focused on horror. So it's 10-minute horror shorts that people submit internationally. We've been doing this for 10 years now. And for us, it's all about celebrating all the different subgenres of horror for an audience, but it's also making sure that it is functional audio drama. We want to make sure that everyone can understand everything that's happening if they close their eyes and keep them closed and just listen to it like they would. They were listening to Tales of Suspense or Lights Out back in the day. But at the same time, the Chicago theater scene is really vibrantly experimental. Mm-hmm. And we're on stage for a reason. So we also want to prioritize having high spectacle opportunities for the audience that is watching us the whole time. So the house of the storytelling with these really visceral and grotesque sound effects is really important to us too.
Yes, exciting. And how do people get to submit to this? Do they just pop onto your website and find a link? Or have you got a certain window of time where people can send you things?
We do have a window of time every year where we're taking submissions. We do recommend that people like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram and Twitter, you know, like us, review us, send your friends to us the same way every other audio drama thrives. Mm-hmm. But our window is the summertime, the end of April through the end of July. Cool. Is when we want you to send us your scary stories so we can see if we can make you part of our party.
So exciting. So you've got time to make stuff up. for a couple of Absolutely. Months before the window opens. Brilliant. So fantastic. I'm really excited. I wish I lived closer because I would love to come down and see you whenever you're performing, but I can't. But currently, those people who aren't quite sure what Foley is, could you give us your definition of what Foley is?
Absolutely. The term Foley is named after Jack Foley, who was a pioneer in this industry I think it was Warner Brothers back in the 30s and 40s, when the talkies were getting to be a thing in the films, because, you know, radio was already happening. Film, however, had been silent, and suddenly Showboat, which was supposed to be the next big thing, but was a musical and didn't have any soundtrack to it. The industry was saying, oh my God, we're going to lose money if we don't have sound on this as well. And so Jack, who was an engineer and a musician and just a pretty brilliant guy, was told that he needed to figure out how to put sound effects to this story for them. And they would go to Foley's studio, as it became commonly known, to implement all of the sound effects. And that's how the name caught on in that respect. There are other pioneers of similar storytelling in sound like him, but his name has kind of become the catch-all, like Kleenex or Xerox have. One of my other favorite people that I always like to look at as an inspiration is Jim McDonald, who did a lot of the same work for Walt Disney Studio back in the day. He not only put all of these sound effects in, but he was a voice of Mickey Mouse and of one of the dwarves in Snow White. But, the things that they came up with when they were trying to figure out what something should sound like is really groundbreaking. And we don't really have an appreciation for how much their work has really conditioned us in the ideas of what storytelling should sound like. And I think a lot of our generation, I'm in my 30s, were the last group before, like, the internet really took hold that had a more canonized idea of what storytelling was. Because we had fewer sources for these narratives, we had a lot more stories in common, like the Hanna-Barbera cartoons and the Disney cartoons. You can go so many other places. There's so many different channels for things to stick your kids in front of these days that they're not going to have nearly so much shared vocabulary as our generation did. Yes. And it's interesting to me that that's like the way that we all know what sneaking, what tiptoeing is supposed to sound like. It sounds like a... And everyone knows that if you were actually trying to tiptoe, that wouldn't be very helpful. It made that noise every time because it's supposed to be silent. But that's how we are conditioned to understand that's what's going on in a story.
Mm. Although I think did do that noise would be very funny to wear. But yes. and with regards to your opinion again, I mean, do you think it's better to use Foley than recorded sound effects?
Really? I do. I think it's more personal that way. I think that you have a more of a stake in making sure that it sounds exactly like the story you're trying to tell. And there are also some liabilities that people, like, the more you know about your discipline, the more options you have and the more opportunities you have to personalize and celebrate the way you're communicating with your audience.
Sure.
So we all, you know what the Wilhelm scream is, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For those of you who might not know, there is a sound effect. It is the sound of a person screaming, and you would know it if you heard it, because it has gone from thing that people started noticing was used a lot to thing that people try to sneak into things as a punchline or as an Easter egg. And it sounds kind of like, and it's used in a lot of George Lucas films. Mm-hmm. It's used in Spielberg films. It's been used since probably the 50s, I want to say. But if you were using that and you didn't realize it was famous and also kind of a punchline, then you might be setting yourself up for inadvertent comedy in a situation where you don't actually want it to be funny. So knowing your source material can only ever help you make intelligent and informed choices. And I think that's one of the reasons why I like to use Foley rather than pre-recorded sounds when it's at all possible.
Sure, and it's much more exciting, isn't it, to find out what sounds things make that you didn't think would make it with that thing. But
that's a really good point too. Yeah, the idea of sound versus the actuality of sound is another really long conversation.
Yes.
Like, it's kind of like how we all agree that a grape-flavored candy doesn't really taste like a grape, but we've agreed to call it a grape.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Good analogy.
So that same kind of theory informs sound design too.
Yes, exciting, because I've seen videos and all sorts of people punching cabbages and leather jackets and all sorts to get the right punch sound and so on and so forth. So yeah, I think it's quite an interesting development as to how things can be manipulated to make the sound you want.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and with regards to your processes, because I think that's what people are keen to fathom. So say you have the script before you. Can you talk us through your process? What do you do in sorting from the moment that you get the script? Joe Griffin
sure.
has asked, could you describe your process, script analysis, auditioning and developing sounds, rehearsal with and without actors and so on? So quite a long drawn out process, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I might do a little bit more like running around on crazy tangents again, just because so much of the process, the more you do something, the more like interconnected your steps become, because you know it's eventually going to get to the point where you need to be considering these different facets of your process. Mm-hmm. So you might be reading a script for the first time and be faced with a squishing noise and get excited about how the squishing noise is going to inform the rest of the things that you're going to be doing during the course of that piece. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't necessarily think to start that way. So right. It's just an example of how excited you can get the more familiar you are with what it is you've been doing, and how like the process, while it in theory is step by step, those steps tend to get a little on top of each other and dogpile when they get exciting. But the first part of the process is just like a traditional sound designer, is read your script, read it a lot, yep. and look at the sounds that are specifically called for in the script versus the ones that you also think probably will help to embroider the world and make it bigger and richer and a more complete story. And think about the ways that the environments work for and against you as far as specificity too. When you don't have all of your senses to work with, then that means you probably have to do a little bit more specific tailoring for this narrative to help your audience know what is important. Mm-hmm. Like if you are doing something that takes place in a dental studio, then yeah, you might have drilling going on from all different parts of the office. But mm-hmm. if it's not important to this person whose face is getting drilled in right now, then those might be more distracting than helpful. Even if they were be like accurate, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's helpful for telling your audience what story they're supposed to be getting
yes.
at that time. And another thing, like the differences between the ways that we've been conditioned to have a complete soundscape when we see everything versus when we just need to be led a little bit more by the nose to know exactly why we're in this room, why we're hearing this part of the exposition. So mm-hmm. It's making everything utilitarian. Uh-huh. It's giving it all reasons. It's earning the medium and it's earning the sounds as they are important and relevant to the story.
Yes, it's aural signposting, really, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Signpost is a really good way of thinking of it. Yeah. Mm. So, like, yeah, I will start out with a spreadsheet that has a breakdown for me of the sound effects I'm going to need to tell this story. And then the next step, once I've decided what all of the sound effects are, is what they should sound like, which seems like it would be like redundant to what those sound effects are. But part of that is building the world of the story. Like someone getting smacked in the head with a mallet is going to sound very different if it's a slapstick comedy, or if it's a horror story, yes. or if it's a dramatic story. Like those all have very different connotations and inform your world and your character's next steps in different ways.
Sure. I mean, just as a tangent, could you give us examples of what you'd use for each of those? So slapstick, dramatic, and horror.
Sure. Like if you're in a slapstick comedy, then you might, rather than hit someone on the head, you might put the emphasis on what is hitting them on the head. Like if they just got smacked by a garbage can, then you would whack a gong mm-hmm. and then they'd probably do a little bit of vocal reacting. And then you might want to put in some Tweety birds like it was a real cartoon. So dung, ah, for the sounds of the birds tweeting overhead. Yep. And then they shake that off and go on with the rest of their day because mm-hmm. it was a slapstick comedy and that sort of thing doesn't really have that big an influence over the rest of their day. They've got things to do and other things to fall on. But in a drama or a serious story, then it might just be the sound of them getting knocked out, like with the sound of a fist hitting a boxing glove. And then when you are dealing with a horror story, then maybe this hit is doing a lot more sustainable damage to this character. So that's when you're going to get into the crunchy things, the juicy things,
like yucky.
The celery and the lettuce and the cabbage. And we've had some really fun things with that in Wildclaw shows as well, where the audience is starting to get a little bit of bloodlust in them when they see these veggies come out. And they want to, and that tells them that things are going to get violent, things are going to get visceral in really funny ways, and that heightens the engagement in surprising ways for them. It makes them remember that it's a horror story.
Richard Brooks actually asked, can you eat celery without wincing?
I always like to pretend it's rehearsal. I don't have any unfortunate, like, I have not been celeried out. That probably surprises a lot of people out there, because let's face it, it's not our most popular veg out there, but it still does its job if you need a snack or you need a conduit for peanut butter. And sometimes when I'm not around other people, I might eat it more dramatically than I normally would, just for the sake of getting a little bit of lab time in.
Test that sound. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So you've got your Excel spreadsheet. You've decided, you know, what kind of genre of sound you're looking at. What's your next stage? And how do you decide, like, what you're going to use for each thing as well?
That is the next crucial thing, is once you've decided what the sound is going to sound like, you are determining your props. And that's going to be dictated somewhat by what your budget is and by what you have that you can beg, borrow, or steal from other people. But yeah, the props list then has the caveat of, have it? Question mark. That would be the next square on the spreadsheet to determine whether or not this is something that I have to go and start hunting around Chicago for, or if it's something that we have in our storage unit, or if it's something that we should not have in our storage unit, like produce, where you have to go and get it fresh every time. That is one of the best things about doing shows in the winter in Chicago, because my car, which becomes the Foley Mobile, can also double as a fridge because we've got sub-freezing temperatures.
Oh, I hope you've got a magnetic sign that says the Foley Mobile on it and you stick on.
It's on my wish.
A red flashing light, or at least sounds blaring out. Woo, woo, we're the Foley Mobile. Yeah, maybe not.
my car goes much more than broom, suffice to say.
Ooh, exciting.
There's an ocean drum that helps me know when I've been braking or hitting the gas a little bit too fervently.
Love it.
And if I have sounds that I have never done before, which is one of the other really exciting things about always working in new works or having new opportunities to collaborate with storytellers, that's what I'll note as a noise party. And that means that that's when I'm going to be probably either meeting with the director and additional members of my Foley team, if I have them, if it's not just me working solo, and saying, okay, these are our candidates for how this sound will be accomplished. If it's the sound of rain, then we might have a rain stick, or we might have the sound of an Alka-Seltzer tab boiling into seltzer for that kind of like just cascading raindrops kind of sound.
Super.
Or we might have a colander that we're pouring water into, so there are droplets that can fall into a tub below it, so you get that water on water impact sound. And these are also things that are going to be dependent on how much space do we have on stage. How skittish is the venue going to be with us having water near their precious microphones? How quick a transition do we have to make between this and the next sound? These are all factors that have to be taken into account when we're determining what is going to be creating this sound effect, because there are some very versatile ways to be approaching a lot of these different sounds, but you'll know which one is right for the particular story you're trying to tell. And sometimes you have to make concessions. I'm going to mention Jim McDonald again, one of my, a bucket list picture that I've seen before of when he was staging a train crash is him in his studio, where, of course, they get multiple takes, which is another factor that you don't have the luxury of in live audio drama. But it's got to be like a 15-foot tall, just stack, precariously structured, all these different metal objects like popcorn tins and cookie sheets and car parts, and they've got a rope ready to pull out from under it so it can all fall and clatter and crash in this wonderfully beautiful way that I would love to get on stage, but you know you will never get to have on stage because it would just be such a mess to pick up, strike, and move on to the next thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can fit in and do, I guess, isn't there, really?
Exactly. And I'm going to tell another desk grab story. Because of the way that we program the shows, it's five finalists, and we'll have three pieces, then an intermission, and then two pieces. And because of all the different ways that people can tell stories in horror, you'll have some skittery ones, and you'll have some slashy ones, you'll have some sloppy ones. And the messiest ones almost always have to end the acts, because that's when we need to do cleanup time. And the pieces that without fail will end the acts are any that involve people vomiting, because that means we're probably pouring cans of soup into buckets on stage, and no one wants to have to smell soup for the rest of the show.
That's beautiful. And Monty Python, it just makes me think of straight away. I'm feeling a bit unwell myself.
But yeah. Oh, yeah, the Crunchy Frog sketch for sure.
Oh, that, okay. But yeah, and with performing, actually, is it just you doing the Foley, or do you employ the cast members to help you or have a team?
It always depends on the venue and the type of show we're doing. There are times when it's just me. When I'm lucky, I have a partner. And when I'm sort of lucky, I have an assistant. And that always is dependent on number of people that you can get for the show, and amount of rehearsal time you can get for the show, and how complex the soundscapes that you're creating for those shows are. Like, there are some things that just take more than two hands to accomplish. Yes. And so that'll be like, hey, I need at least an assistant on this, so I can bring them in for a couple of sounds. Be like, here, hold this. Here, stop this. Here, do this at the same time I'm doing that. And then there are other times when you can have more complex choreography with a full partner at the table. And it's always important to me when I'm choreographing that I make sure that we both have instances to shine, and there'll be moments that we can really like showcase what we're doing to the audience and have a heightened relationship with them. Yes. When we're not directly performing sound effects, we are the most engaged spear carriers you can hope to have, because we're also important to throwing the focus for the audience where they need to be watching. So we're watching the actors, the voice actors, whenever we're not generating our own effects, which yes. means, yet again, one of the biggest issues with production time for live audio drama for the Foley department is you almost definitely have to be off book. And that is very different when it comes to how the voice actors are handling things, because they have their scripts and they're probably only looking up every once in a while to connect with their colleagues, or maybe with the audience, or if there's a sound effect that they're playing off of with you, like if their character is the one vomiting, then they need to be watching you for when your splashing sounds are going to be happening.
Yes.
I know that's gross, but it's it's really fun to create together.
And how much rehearsal of this do you get?
When I'm lucky, we get, and again, that's another one of those things that's a factor for desk scribe, because these are all new works that we've never performed before. I probably can wheedle my way into 3 to 5 rehearsals.
Right.
That first one will be the actors talking them through what the soundscape is going to be like for them, informing the world that they're building for their characters, and explaining to them the way the choreography is going to be affecting their characters. And then maybe the second time I'll bring in as many small hand props as I can that we can make it more accessible for them, have them understand a little bit more of how the mechanics of the process will work. And then anything after that will be as much like fully produced, fully realized runs of the show for everyone to get their feet wet, so to speak, as possible. It's tricky because these are all like, because Chicago's scene is so big and vibrant and busy all the time.
Yes.
A lot of this is being done as like rehearsals in our colleagues' apartments. So it's not like you can come in and say, all right, so where can I set up the soup cannon? This rug good? A lot of it's going to depend on how much space they have for you, how closely the space that you're rehearsing in mimics where you're going to be performing your final pieces, and how messy you can get in those places. If you've got a glitter cannon, people might not want to work with that until the final rehearsal.
And I mean, that's so exciting, isn't it? And just those moments of bringing this all together. Do you find that you kind of get taken in the moment and sort of improvise some more? Have there been any incidents where you've gone above and beyond?
I try to be pretty well behaved, especially in the horror things that we do. But one of the other companies that I work with semi-regularly is a lovely group called Locked in a Vacancy Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And they are exclusively comedy. They do monthly live shows out of one of the most beautiful venues we have in Chicago, the Uptown Underground Lounge. It's set up like velvet curtains down the stairs. Everything's like very like chrome and shiny and speakeasy. Like it looks like it's been around since the 1920s.
Oh, but you know, sounds amazing.
Clean and sexy, yeah. And it's a great venue to really get into the feel of old timey radio style writing. And that's what a lot of the stuff that they're doing is based on. They've got a series called Clark and Belmont, which is kind of Abbott and Costello, like supernatural humor for these like two like patter heavy kind of day laborers. Mm-hmm. And then they've got another one that's the Rogers Sisters, which is based on the Andrew Sisters. It's a quartet of singing sisters that are also fighting Nazis. And they've got like the Groovy Mystery Gang, which is a riff on Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
So they've got all these different serials that they'll cycle through in their monthly show. They'll do two in their monthly show and then they podcast them after the fact. And those are times when I play a little bit more with them. One of my favorite examples of that would be they've got Joe Jupiter, space detective. And one time Joe had run afoul of a mafioso space slug with a cybernetic arm. And that meant that I had a lot of things to play with as far as like creating the sounds of this space slug. I was using a latte foamer for the buzzing of his cybernetic enhancements. But also, because he's a slug, every time he moved, he made a little bit of a farty noise. And nice. So at the big climactic face-off, when he's like walking up to face off with Joe Jupiter, there were probably a couple extra farts thrown in for good measure.
And made by what, may I ask?
Oh, we have so many wonderful things that can fart for us. Let's see, whoopee cushions would be the classic. Yes. One of my favorite go-tos, though, if I'm not just supplementing things with my mouth, you know, so to speak. There's also a wonderful substance called flarp. I'm actually holding a canister of it right now. It is the most well-recognized noise putty on the market. Uh-huh. I always have green on hand because that's my favorite color. And also it looks a little just, you could go with red because we're a horror company, but there's something otherworldly about the color green at the same time that kind of gives everything a bit of a supernatural side to things. It's also the, as far as Stephen King is concerned, the creepiest color for those of you playing at home. And it's just a canister of this goo.
That's just so disgustingly beautiful sound.
Yes. And it just, it wants so desperately to be played with. And the good people at FLARP actually are responsible for my favorite innovation in whoopee cushion technology as well. Ooh. They've got a whoopee cushion that is foam rubber on the inside, like a sponge. Uh-huh. And it also has a hole in the middle that if you hold the hole like closed with your thumb and squeeze it, then it deploys the whoopee functionality. But once you release that hole with your thumb, it automatically reinflates itself. So you have a much faster turnaround with your whoopee cushion noise making needs than ever before. And this is something that we used a lot in a piece that we did a couple of years ago called the Monroe County Pumpkin Queen. It was a body horror piece where this woman was turning miscreants into
pumpkins, I imagine.
Gourds. And one of them wasn't doing very well. She kept having like gaseous, like little issues, like
excretions
coming
out
of her, squishies and kind of those awful noises. And so that was really helpful to have a couple of flarps and a couple of flarpy cushions on hand for that.
I think
until she exploded.
I can hear people running to pack to go to live in Chicago right now and looking up on various websites where to find some flap stuff. Good stuff.
Yes.
I mean, with
they're not paying me at all.
No, free advertising. But as say, with regards to soundscapes, kind of stock go-to things, do you have kind of an environmental haunted house, or, you know, that kind of environment of an ominous environment? How would you create that?
That's a really interesting question. There are some things that you will use to establish soundscapes and then like kind of pan out for, because you're giving people the benefit of the doubt that they'll go with you. And also because there are only going to be probably 2 to 4 to maybe even 6 hands literally on hand to be generating these soundscapes. Mm. Consistent sounds sometimes are a factor, but let's see, for caves, there's the dripping sound and trying to make things as cavernous as possible. Like instead of having a walking surface be wood, you might want to use some stone tile so the footsteps echo in a different way. I've also really enjoyed using a rubber glove to shake it dramatically to be the sound of a bat flying away into the distance.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And when we're working live, you're also able to take advantage of certain things to augment the organic soundscape. Like if you've got reverb options on the mic, if you've got pitch shifting options on the mic, then these are fun things that you can be using to sweeten your arsenal a little bit and make them a little bit more tailored to the environment you're trying to cultivate.
Sure. Can you give us specific examples with that as well?
Sure. When we recently did a Harry Potter homage in Clark and Belmont, we were talking about the castle kind of quality of the house they were going to. And Belmont says, "Oh, look at the size of that door." And so, you know, like the little Foley door that you have isn't necessarily going to cut it. So yes, we've got this big, sexy hinge that has a very dramatic squeak. And we've got a big... big metal slide bolt that we used to bang on each other to be the sound of the heavy knocker on the door, and pitching that down just a little bit and giving it some reverb so it sounds really cavernous and mysterious helped sell that they were opening a door to this ancient place.
That's perfect. We need one of those in 2 weeks' time. That's perfect. And you can do that all live. It works. Yes. Exciting.
Can you come pick me up?
We need you. Get in a box of first class postage, please. But I mean, it's so exciting. Yes, all these different places you can create hourly, I think, is very cool. I've got a question here from Cara Mel Butters. What is your worst Foley mistake?
That probably, they're always wonderful mistakes or happy accidents that you're finding the hard way. A lot of mine would probably be like biting off more than I can chew in different funny ways. When I was first starting to learn and take hold of this discipline, I was very much in my infancy when I was learning about the difference between how you want things to sound and what they actually are to create that sound. So this would be a good example of this would be Earwigs, a piece that we did a couple of years ago in Describe, which involved that urban legend that they crawl in your ear and lay eggs in your head. And so we had a character who was getting a headache that just got worse and worse and worse over the course of the show. And so you know where this is going, because it's a horror story written by Describe winner, multiple Describe winner, Joe Zellemeyer, who is one of my favorite people and a wonderful playwright. You should hire him, too. So we knew that for her head exploding, we were going to be using a pumpkin. And I got so excited about the pumpkin we were going to get for this that I go out shopping and I found a 20-pounder because I thought, oh, this will look great on stage and I'll have a great sexy smash. And this was so ridiculous because the functionality of this, not only was I lugging around a 20-pound pumpkin between rehearsals like an albatross for a couple of weeks, but once we actually tried to use the darn thing, of course its skin was too thick to be adequately punctured and give you that satisfactory smashing noise. Unfortunately, we found this out in rehearsals rather than the hard way on stage in front of several hundred people. Yes. But that is one of those things that really emphasizes to me the importance of experimentation and doing your homework and doing the research before the fact. There's a Foley artist named, I think, Benjamin Burt, who has this wonderful article called The Power of Perseverance. And it's all about the luxury of having time to experiment and make mistakes and find out what does not work. Right. And his slang for that is a chicken hit. Because one time when he was working on punching sounds for a movie, he thought, yeah, getting a raw chicken and hitting the carcass, that should work great. And it didn't. And so chicken hit has become his community's shorthand for the thing that seems like it should work, but really doesn't. And I think we all have those. So it's nice when we afford ourselves the time to have those not in front of a paying audience.
Makes perfect sense. Karen Mailbutters goes on to ask you, what's your most serendipitous Foley find? Yes, please share your trademark secrets.
There are so many things that have been happy accidents. When it comes to researching the sounds in the first place, if it's something that you don't necessarily have on hand, because that's usually where you get your creative juices flowing. If you're at home with your little satellite supply of effects, or if you're at your office and you're just like playing with things and you go, hey, wait a second, this stapler carriage sounds like a trampoline if you play with it this way, then that's one of those funny things that you just like stick in your back pocket for later. And it's so nice when you get a chance to say, oh, this is that effect that I've been excited about trying for so long. We were doing a noise party for Monroe County Pumpkin Queen, trying to figure out how to make her explode on stage. And that resulted for me in a lot of YouTubing of watching people popping water balloons. Actually, one of my favorite videos would be of a puppy snapping water balloons and popping them. Because figuring out where the sound actually occurs in that situation was very important. Because it's not the actual popping, it's the splashing afterwards. So making sure the audience could see you suspending a balloon over what was going to be catching the water that actually results. Because the popping is the exciting part. Mm-hmm. And we had just a couple of rehearsals where we weren't quite getting the timing right. And then accidentally, someone pops the balloon, the air balloon, because it actually needed to be two balloons in tandem. And that was the sweet spot. And realizing, oh, it needs to be two balloons, was like a lightning bolt. Cool. And when we experimented with that, with the actress who was doing such a great, hilarious job of sounding like she didn't feel right before the explosion, A, an explosion, B, of the splashing, and then some supplementary cascading flarp putty noises after that of like to indicate the bits that are still falling to the ground, and just the peals of laughter from the actors that weren't actually in the scene but were watching that day is one of my fondest memories. And I was just jumping up and down saying, yes, this is what we want the audience to get.
I'm quite gutted there's nobody exploding in any of the scripts we're doing in a few weeks.
No, there's always next year.
Yes, there is always another time for sure. Oh, brilliant. And I've got at Frogsov on Twitter asks, how do you handle sound elements that don't exactly have real life equivalents, like fantasy monsters or futuristic technologies? I love that question.
That is where noise parties really come into play, like the exploratory, the creative experimentation, where you think like, okay, what kind of qualities do we want from this monster? And you play with the voice actors that you have, and you see if you can be working in tandem with them, if you can be heightening their natural capabilities with effects. We've had a couple of instances with hauntings and with monsters. And one of the ones that I really like is we had a little girl who was possessed by her imaginary friend, who turned out to be the ghost of a very angry little boy. Mm-hmm. And so that was accomplished by having the voice actress and my second at the Foley table, who is a gentleman who's a very talented designer, performer, creator in the live in the audio drama community as well, Jeffrey Gardner of Our Fair City. He whispered in a little boy voice, just on a slight delay from when she was saying the things that she was having dictated to her by the little boy ghost. Okay. And so that was really cool and kind of had that like stuttery kind of haunted poltergeist. Mm. Yeah. And in another show from that same year, a character had lost his humanity. He had been reduced to a strictly carnivorous monster. Mm-hmm. And the actor actually had a really good snarl and howl that he could do. But in order to give him higher range, we got to a certain point in his range where he was almost out of voice. And then I took over. So it started really low and guttural and went up into this otherworldly shriek that no one should have the range for, which was really cool. So it's another one of the things like figuring out what your acting ensemble can do and what the table can offer for them. And then like if you have things like spaceships and or otherworldly beings that don't necessarily have like vocal cords, figuring out like combining what we know with what is unknown. And so like squiggly kind of sound effects or crunchy kind of sound effects. We use a lot of things like we repurpose toys.
Yes.
For like their electronic or mechanical sounds. Mm-hmm. Or like using world instruments or just the crazy things that you can find at Ren fairs. Like all of these things are part of your arsenal. And I really like when possible to defer to recognizable objects that the audience will have an experience or a relationship to already, because I think that heightens the sense of play that they're bringing to the storytelling. If they recognize that this thing is also a character, is also an actor helping to tell the story, not only does it give them a new context for that thing that they're bringing into the story as is, but it's something that they're taking home with them. I can't think of anyone that has had the same relationship to celery after seeing a Wild Claw show afterwards that they did before.
Do you sell branded stamped Wild Claw celery? You should at the end of the show. Stick away.
More than anything, I want us to get involved with food pantries, so maybe we can do some sort of donation to them as well. Food awareness, like the waste that goes on. Like I feel bad for what I am contributing, and I want us to be helping them monetarily, stepping them up and getting them like more visibility.
Yeah,
because of the way that we're using it, they're also what they have a much more noble aspiration for, you know?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this is it. I think that's a massive issue, isn't it, worldwide? So being very conscious of that and trying to help it is fantastic. Absolutely. So yes, if you've got any ideas, send them in to Ellie. We'll put all her contact details and Wild Claw and so on our show notes. So please do check those if you'd like to get in touch. But finally, really, we're just looking at tech-wise. How do you record the actual effects? What do you set up to capture these tech-wise?
Because we're almost always performing in concert venues like the Main Stage or Lincoln Hall, then we're almost always getting recordings from the board that we then will do what we can. Like it's the bare mix from the board, like that we're then mixing for our podcast to recreate what is closer to what the audience heard than is just like everything at a single level, which is tricky, but also teaches me a lot about like what it is that reads and doesn't. And I'm really lucky that I have colleagues that are more adept on the engineering and designing and mixing side of traditional sound work that I can lean on in that respect. A regular contributor to Wild Claw is Joe Griffin, actually, and he and I have been working on the mixes for Describe 10, which just happened in December. And I cannot speak highly enough about how helpful he has been in helping me further my own craft. And superb. I'm always excited when he and I get to work together.
Yes. Oh, he sounds fabulous. So, I mean, with that, do you have just shotgun mics, just one or two set up? What specifically do you have to capture?
It depends on the scope of the show. Usually for Describe, we'll have a number of condenser mics for the Foley table. We'll have probably two set at mouth level for my partner and I for like close effects or vocal effects. And then we'll have one in the middle that lives over the walking board where we're doing the majority of the foot traffic or anything that we need to be able to set down and just let run until mm-hmm. it gets taken away. And then we'll have another one dedicated to body fall, like the no man's land that belongs to breaking glass, opening and closing the Foley door, and body fall sound effects.
Yes. Okay. All of those sound brilliant. So give us, I'm going to give you a quick fire round, actually. I'm going to ask you to tell us what you would use very quickly for each of these effects live. Are you ready?
There's
some really exciting music now to put in. Go. Music is in. Question number one, what would you use to make fire?
Fire would be a combination of cellophane and bubble wrap for the popping in the fireplace. If it's a conflagration, then you might have additional like cloth whipping sounds or just mouth wind like for it actually taking hold of the forest or wherever is on fire.
Superb. Second question, thunder. What do you make to thunder?
Thunder. I love the Thunder Tube. It is a classic membrane drum with a coil that you are twisting and turning and shaking and letting reverberate. And then you can strike the two of them together for the thunder strikes. You can also use thunder sheets, which are long and thin sheets of metal that you can either shake or strike or even bow, like with a violin bow, if you want some sustained sounds.
Superb. Footsteps up and down the stairs.
Footsteps up and down the stairs. It's really more a cadence thing than it is a change in the way that you're making them, because you're still going to be using a walking board, but you need to just give a different kind of emphasis to the way the steps are occurring to give people the indication that people are either walking upstairs or jumping down them hastily. That's going to affect the patter of the way that you're walking, because it's not level ground.
Very good. Okay, number four, fight punches. Give us a couple of ranges of things you could use for fight punches.
Fight punches. A boxing glove with your hand, a head of lettuce with your hand, or maybe a rolled up bit of newspaper. My favorite example I've not gotten to use, but is on my bucket list, is a story from Fight Club, where apparently some of the bigger body blows that they employed were filling a chicken carcass with walnuts and smashing it with a mallet.
That just sounds like fun anyway.
Right?
Brilliant. And finally, gunshots. How could you make some gunshots on stage?
Gunshots. Oh, they're one of the scourges of the live audio drama community. I often use a pair of book claps, as I call them. It's a couple of hardcover sides of a book with tape on them, so you can hold them on your hands, kind of like you would mittens, and smack them. But you can also pop balloons, or you can use champagne poppers. The factors in play are how far away are you from the gunshots? How realistic do they need to be for an actual gun versus the cartoonified version of what we're familiar with through movies like shotguns and that crazy reverb that doesn't actually happen? You can also try snaps, which are those little rolled up bits of gunpowder and paper.
Yes. See, your whole life just must be so much fun. You've passed that test beautifully. Thank you. That was so well done. Brilliant. So just to finally finish up, really, what would be your top tips of advice for anyone who wants to do what you do? What would you advise them to do to get into it?
Oh, you are only as good an artist as you are a member of your community. So anytime you hear of something in this vein that is going on in your town, make every effort possible to go out and see them. That is not only how you're going to learn yourself, but you're also going to learn who your community and who the artists that you're inspired by are, and hopefully get to work with them someday. I am lucky enough that live audio drama is a loosey-goosey enough phrase that there are so many different ways to interpret it, and I'm very excited every time I get to see a new ensemble create what they think fits those terms. And I learn either a new technique or a new storytelling structure or what not to do every time I see a production that falls in this mold. And I'm so lucky for it. Go out, learn from the people that you want to be making work with. Also, Pinterest, YouTube, Google things online. There are wonderful sound documentaries for most of the big action movies from the past 20 years will do stuff like extra DVD footage where you can see the hows of this discipline and try to figure out what happened in that movie that was so exciting to you that you can then repurpose for a stage show. Another one of these things that I really love that I learned through a documentary on, I think, oh goodness, it was Bourne Identity, is the car chasing. The squealing of tires they use in car chases is actually just a rubber water bottle with a little bit of air in it that you hug and you twist around on a wooden surface, and it'll squeal like the Dickens. And that's what is happening in all those Mach 1 racer Fast and Furious movies.
Amazing. I think that's what's fun, isn't it? When you can see the footage of the film and what has made those sounds. I think that's fascinating. So if you want to see Foley in full action, then you must go and see some Wild Claw Theatre action over in amazing Chicago.
Yeah, because when it comes to how onstage Foley realization is different from in-studio Foley realization, the biggest thing is when it comes to that high spectacle I was talking about, again, we're on stage for a reason. And Chicago, being an industry town, like, we're so suffused with the arts and with storytelling that the more familiar you are with the what of the story being told, the more creative risks you should be taking with the how the story is told. I think that's another one of the reasons why live audio drama, or the reasons why podcasting and audio drama narrative is taking hold with younger generations, because this is a different way of absorbing the stories that they've seen in cartoons and movies and TV shows for the past 20, 30 years. And so there are some theories that are unique to the stagecraft that I'd love to talk a little bit about. So a couple of things to keep in mind are, I mentioned at one point, sense of play. That to me means the ways that you get the audience invested that surprise themselves. And I mentioned before, one of the things is using recognizable objects, which I think gets them more engaged and gets them further down the rabbit hole in ways they don't realize. one of my favorite examples is I was in a production with Lifeline Theater here in Chicago where they were recreating some of the old Shadow scripts. And one of the stories involved a strangler who, because this was old-timey and kind of silly, not only was strangling his victims, but he would always come back for their pet. And so there was an instance where one of the victims had a pet parrot that was realized through rah, 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 that kind of screechy, squawky kind of noise, as well as an umbrella getting flapped liberally for the sound of its feathers getting all a jostle. Yes. And when strangler comes in and wrings the neck of this parrot, everyone in the audience gasps or whines or bemoans the loss of, when you come down to it, this umbrella that they can see and just met like 5 minutes earlier. But I think that speaks to the how eager people are to connect. We've all seen so many Disney movies that have an anthropomorphized object in them, like the rug and a lamp in Aladdin, or Johnny Fedora and Alice Bluebonnet. We love to give personalities to objects. And so it surprises us when we get really emotionally connected to them. Another thing to keep in mind is the idea of closure. This is something I've stolen hook, line, and sinker from Scott McLeod's Understanding Comics. For comic strip writers and creators, comprehension of story moments occurs in the gutter. That is the space in between panels. Alfred Hitchcock used this in Psycho. He famously doesn't have any blood on screen when Janet Leigh is being murdered. The camera work goes from showing the knife to showing the screaming lady to showing the knife to showing the sink drain to showing dead lady. The audience is the one that connects all of those story points together and have, in a way, become complicit with this woman's death. This is another way of getting them further into the story that you're telling. Another important thing to keep in mind is the more people are invested in what's going on at the Foley table and the more their sense of play is engaged, the more you have to be careful about when you are revealing things, when they might be ahead of you as far as whose shoes they see you about to pick up, or when there's a phone on the table that you haven't used yet, they might realize that means that a phone call is going to happen. Because also, for the sake of your own real estate, you're not going to have props on stage that you're not ultimately going to be using. It's very Chekhovian. One of my favorite examples of this would be going back to earwigs with the woman who had that splitting headache. There came a point in her dialogue where I had to put on an apron, go in front of the table that we had been using for all of our Foley props, and pull a drop cloth off of the pumpkin. Not a 20-pounder, mind you. This time it was more like five. And pull out a sledgehammer. Because the audience had made the connection that something was going to happen, and we had to pinpoint the right point in the story to reveal to them that they were right and help them build the anticipation for that pumpkin getting smashed.
Superb. I can imagine the grandiose gesture you can do pulling off that cloth as well. Marvelous.
Oh, it's so much fun. The things, like, there are two things that I find to be like most rewarding as far as audience reactions when it comes to this form of storytelling. The first one being where if you have an intermission where the audience gets a chance to come up and look at the table, if you have people like pointing at things and making demands of you, I want to know what that's going to get used for. And then if they start telling you what they think it's going to get used for, then you know you've gotten them like fully engaged and totally imagining what's going on in this world that is only sound. The other one being when people ask after the fact how they can get involved in this kind of storytelling. And Wildclaw's Death Scribe is, of course, the one that I am most biased toward. And I hope that anyone that's listening to this program is interested in following up with us at the end of April when we start our submissions for Death Scribe 11. But if horror isn't necessarily your jam, there are other ways of submitting and becoming a storyteller in this discipline. I know that you've got your own. We've also got Whiskey Radio Hour here in Chicago, which is all genres of storytelling, and they are currently taking submissions. So I'd recommend looking up Whiskey Rebellion Theater for more information on how to submit to them. And that's kind of what I've got for that.
Superb. No, fantastic array of things to get stuck into. And I'm sure there's people out there yearning to kind of, you know, try their hand at it if they haven't before, or maybe even some seasoned pros you found somewhere else to throw their brilliant scripts. So yes, brilliant. Okay, I think we can slot that bit in, no problem, earlier. That's fine.
Yes, thank you.
No, brilliant, brilliant, brilliantly said, beautifully said. And I just wonder, have you ever missed the pumpkin with the sledgehammer?
No, fortunately, no, not I guess not yet. I'm knocking on all the wood around me right now.
Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said it, should I?
I mean, there are plenty of, like, there are always ways that performances can go better. It's the double-edged sword that is live theater. You get such a high off of the possibilities and the risks, and not everything's going to go the way you want it to. Sometimes you're going to drop things, sometimes it's going to bounce, sometimes it's going to splash the wrong way, but so far I've survived every time. And as a performer and in the live arts, the best you can hope for is the opportunity to do it better the next time.
Huge thanks, Elliot. It's been really brilliant to talk to you. And I'm sure you've enthused a lot of people to try and look around their house and see what noises things make.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. It blows my mind that we've been talking for an hour already.
It's crazy, isn't it? And I'm sure we could go on for a long, long time. But huge thanks for all your amazing help.
Thank you so much. This was lovely.